gotcha. Separate the weak from the ops. Leak hard to creep them Brooklyn streets. It's on again, fuck all that bickering beef. I can hear sweat trickling down your cheek. Your heartbeat sound like Sasquatch feet. Thundering, shaking the concrete. Then the shit stop when I fall the plot. Neighbors call the cops and they heard mad shots. Saw me in the drop, 3 1/4. Slaughter, electrical tape around the door. Old school, new school, need to learn though. I burn, baby, burn like disco inferno. Burn slow like blunts with yayo. Peel more skins than Idaho potatoes.
Mr. President, the only hot war we've got running at the moment is, of course, the one in Vietnam.
I don't think that unless a greater effort is made by the government to win popular support, that the war can be won out there. In the final analysis, it's their war. They're the ones who have to win it or lose it.
I heard agents say that if anyone should try to assassinate the president, that they wouldn't respond. They say if shots were fired, that they would back rather than give their life to the president, for the president, because of his racial integration policies. I actually heard agents say this.
Seemed normal as the President's Secret Service bodyguards kept their ever-watchful eyes on the crowd. The agent in charge, Amory Roberts, as he stands in the Secret Service follow-up car and motions with his hand. What he is doing is calling away the President's two most important bodyguards. Calling away the President's two most important bodyguards. Calling away the President's two most important bodyguards. The bodyguards whose job was to protect the President's back by riding on the bumper of the limousine throughout the motorcade. He stands and orders the agents running at the rear of the president's car away. The confusion inside the follow-up car that results. One of two agents whose job was to hop aboard the bumper and act as human shields. He's obviously perplexed as he shrugs his shoulders 3 times in dismay, each shrug more dramatic than the last. Ask yourself, is this the kind of conduct you would expect from an agency that routinely sends an advance team to a city a month or more prior to the president's arrival in order to make preparations? Now ask yourself if the assassination could have taken place at all had those men been on the bumper during the motorcade. The president, unaware of the treachery behind him and the danger waiting for him ahead, continued on to his death. Segments from 3 of at least 4 films shot in Dealey Plaza of the assassination. The 4th was confiscated by the FBI and has never been released for public viewing.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You'll excuse the fact that I'm out of breath, but about 10 or 15 minutes ago, a tragic thing, from all indications at this point, has happened in the city of Dallas. Let me quote to you this. And you'll excuse me if I am out of breath. A bulletin, this is from the United Press, from Dallas. President Kennedy and Governor John Connally have been cut down by assassin's bullets in downtown Dallas. They were riding in an open automobile when the shots were fired. The president, his limp body carried in the arms of his wife Jacqueline, has rushed to Parkland Hospital. And if you'll excuse me if I give some directions, we talk about what we're going to do here for the next few minutes. But Bobby, let's tape this, if you please, particularly the interview with the eyewitness people. It is being taped good.
On November 22nd, 1963.
May I have your name, please, sir?
My name is Abraham Zapruder.
And would you tell us your story, please, sir?
I got out and about a half hour earlier, getting to a good spot to shoot some pictures. And I found a spot, one of these concrete blocks that I have down near that park near the underpass. And I got up top there, there was another girl from my office, she was right behind me. And as I was shooting, as the president was coming down from Houston Street making his turn, he was about halfway down there, I had a shot. And he slumped to the side, like this. Then I had another shot or two, I couldn't say it was one or two. And I saw his head practically open up, all blood and everything, and I kept on shooting. That's about all. I'm just sick again.
I think that pretty well expresses the entire feelings of the whole world.
Terrible.
You have the film in your camera. We'll
try I brought it on the studio.
We'll try to get that processed and have it as soon as possible.
Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States. Mrs. Kennedy was stunned, but not in a state of shock as yet.
The police in Dallas, Texas are convinced they have the man. This is the man charged with the murder of President Kennedy.
There is Lee Oswald. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot.
John Fitzgerald Kennedy's final journey. Mrs. Kennedy holding back her tears, as indeed she has publicly ever since the tragic events of Friday.
I tell you, boy, I stayed up late last night reading this book, Echo from Dealey Plaza. Brother Abraham Bolden, the first African-American on the White House Secret Service detail under the President John F. Kennedy. How are you doing, Sam?
Good this morning. How are you?
I'm sleepy this morning because of your book. But I tell you, all I kept doing is thinking that, wow, my goodness. You know, having gone to law school, and there are some cases that we have to read in law school, that there's a Buckner Creek disaster. We saw movies like The Firm. We had to see movies like Aaron Brockovich. If there is a book that should be read in all law schools right now, because you take us through a number of different things. You take us from the lower courts all the way to the high courts here. It's a very sexy story as well. There's power in this. There's racism in this. There's history in this. My goodness, absolutely incredible. Tell me this. How are you feeling right now as a result of having gone through this experience? And then we'll talk about the book.
Well, I feel it was a challenging experience. I think I grew from having this experience, and it really added my intelligence concerning the justice system and how we have to fight for truth and justice. And I think that it made me a better individual, you know, as ironic as it might seem, and it gave me a broad perspective as to how things really are here in America.
Okay, what I want you to do now is give us a summary of everything that happened, and then just as brief as you can, what happened to you in a few sentences, and then we're going to go back, and then we're going to take it all the way through.
Yes.
What happened to you? Who are you? Who were you? And what happened to you?
Well, I began a police career in St. Louis, Missouri as a Pinkerton National Detective. And I went from there into the Illinois State Police. In 1960, I joined the United States Secret Service, where I happened to meet President Kennedy when he came to Chicago here. After serving a probationary period on the White House detail of 30 days, I was very disenchanted with the type of protection that the president was getting, and I made my thoughts known. As a matter of fact, I was so vociferous about those lack of protection that the president was receiving that I became known as sort of a disgruntled person when it came to the protection of President Kennedy. And subsequently, after the president was assassinated, there was a case that was cooked up against me in the federal district court system here in Chicago. And I was sent away to prison for 3 years and 3 months on trumped up charges of bribery and soliciting a bribe and conspiracy. And that about sums up what happened.
Okay, tell me, why did you go into law enforcement?
I have always have had an affinity for law enforcement. Lucy Hogan, who happened to live up the street from me, was one of my role models as I grew up, and he was an East St. Louis detective, and there was just something about being a detective. And when I finished Lincoln University, I have a Bachelor of Music from Lincoln University, my wife and I, while I was teaching accordion lessons, this affinity for police work came back, and I happened to see this job for Pinkerton National Detective in the newspaper, and that began my journey into law enforcement.
Okay, from there, you met Kennedy. Of course, everybody who read history, I know that was a very, very close election where he ran against Nixon. He beat out Lyndon Baines Johnson in the primary, and it's great that we have a primary right now. We're in a mayor right there in Chicago. Actually, mayor and Democrat from Chicago, or not so much from Chicago, but claiming Chicago as a home. Hillary and Obama.
Yeah.
That he beats Nixon. A very close race, and some people say it's because of the Daley machine.
Yeah.
The reason he beat him out. So you end up meeting him very early on after he became president or before he became president?
That I saw him before he became president as a member of the state police. He was a young senator. He came to Peoria in order to, he was campaigning, and this happened to be in the early part of October in 1960. Well, he won the election. And in the meantime, I came into the United States Secret Service in October 1960, shortly after he had appeared in Peoria. So when he came to Chicago at one of the banquets to thank Mayor Daley on April 28th for the support that the Democratic machine in Chicago had given him, I was a Secret Service agent here in Chicago.
What did you think when you first met John F. Kennedy? What kind of man was he?
John F. Kennedy, to me, impressed me as a person who was very sincere about engendering racial equality for all Americans. He wanted to bring about a change in America where a person would be regarded for their ability rather than for their complexion. And I felt that he was very sincere about this. I saw it in his eyes. I saw it in the way that he talked to me. And as I say, I first met him at McCormick Place here in Chicago, and it was really ironic how I did meet him.
When he met you, tell me the conversation.
Well, I was stationed at a washroom here at McCormick Place on the bottom level of McCormick Place. Now, that washroom had been set aside for the use of the president only. And normally, a Chicago policeman would be given that detail because it's considered somewhat menial and it's away from the activities of the president. And at the time that I was assigned that detail, there was a lot of snickering in the office and there was a lot of joking about me being assigned to the washroom. Well, as things would turn out, when the motorcade arrived at McCormick Place that night, the first thing that President Kennedy wanted to do was use the washroom.
Mm-hmm.
And there I stood. And as he came walking towards me, he stood right in front of me to the extent that I thought I was blocking his entrance into the washroom. But he wanted to have a conversation with me. And he asked me, was I in fact a Secret Service agent or was I one of Mayor Daley's finest? Mm-hmm. And I told him I was a Secret Service agent. And he went on to ask me, had there ever been a Negro on the Secret Service White House detail? And I told him, not to my knowledge, Mr. President. And he asked me if I would like to be the first. I said, yes, sir, Mr. President. He said, I'll be looking forward to seeing you in Washington, D.C. And I tell you, I was just floored. I couldn't believe my ears. It was like a dream, you know, hear the President of the United States acknowledging me right on the spot like that. And I couldn't wait to tell my wife. I couldn't wait to tell my wife that I had met the President of the United States, one of the most beloved presidents of the United States that we'd ever had.
Right. Oh, Bob, we'll talk about that. So, at this point, you end up going to Washington. Let's get to Washington. Now you're there in Washington, D.C., and you're on the detail. Describe the first day in Washington, D.C.
My first day in Washington, D.C. was like a dream. When I walked into the White House, it was not really the first time I've been in the White House, because as a young Secret Service agent going to the Internal Revenue School, we had made a short tour of the White House. But to be there on assignment, it was just marvelous. The etched floors, and then being able to see on a tour that was given to me by Agent Stu Stout, who was the lead of the shift, being able to see the president's desk, his rocking chair, and the tour of the White House when there was actually no one in it visible to see. We could just tour it at our leisure time, and it was a remarkable experience for me.
Wow. Okay. When you get there, you're the first black now.
Yes.
And all the Secret Service there are white.
Yes.
Describe how they treat you.
Well, it got off to a rocky start. I was studying what they call a United States Secret Service manual. I came in the second night that I was there, and the place where I had marked in the manual where I had began and where I had ended from the night before, there was a memorandum with a picture drawn on the back. And this picture was an exaggerated depiction of a black man, of an African American, with very large lips. His face was colored black. His eyes were white, and had little beads drawn for hair. So I turned the memo over, and I began to read the memo. And it was, in fact, from the special agent in charge in the Miami office. Just really telling the Secret Service not to bring me to Miami, Florida when the president came, because they couldn't accommodate me, that the hotel there would not accommodate a Negro agent, as the memo said. So I copied that memo and put it back into the manual. I wanted to draw out and find out just who was responsible for doing that. And I wanted to remain some question as to whether or not I had even seen the memo. So it got off to a rocky start.
Let me read this passage right here. Agents were breaking out the drinks. And this is from your book, The Echo from Daily Plaza, by Mr. Abraham Bolden. Agents were breaking out the drinks. Henderson sat on the living room couch, opened a beer, and leveled a cold, hard stare at me, which I did my best to ignore. He kept it up through two or three quick beers until he finally spoke. "Morgan, you're Harvey," he said. "I'm going to tell you something, and I don't want you ever to forget it." The sound of the South was heavy in his voice. "You're a nigger. You were born a nigger, and when you die, you'll still be a nigger. You will always be nothing but a nigger, so act like one." Talk about that experience right there.
Yes, my legs actually went weak. I was not expecting anyone to be that overt so far as their racial attitudes was concerned. And when he called me that, my mind was raised, and I had to think fast how to respond to such a overt act of racism. Naturally, it raised my temper a bit. But I was able to control myself, and I just remembered a lot of what Dr. Martin Luther King had taught, and I just said, "I love you too, Harvey. I love you too." And I let it go as that, because I felt that he was trying to draw me into a situation which would have been a no-win situation for me. If I had attacked him for his words, I would have been wrong, and there was just no way out for me except to graciously bow out of that situation, which I did.
Not only did he not like you? But I'm sure that festered because the president, Kennedy, remembered you right away when you got there to Washington, D.C., and he introduced you to some people there. Talk about that introduction when you first met him there in Washington, D.C.
Yes, I happened to have a post outside of President Kennedy's office, and they were breaking up from one of the cabinet meetings, and I was standing right in front of the president's door. So as the members of Congress and the Senate were leaving the cabinet room, I reached in to close the door, and the president was standing there at that time. He was talking to Bobby Kennedy, and he looked up and he said, "Oh, Mr. Boland, I see you made it here to Washington, D.C. And he commenced to introduce me to Hubert Humphrey and Barry Goldwater, who were the majority and the minority Senate leaders at that particular time.
How did Hubert Humphrey receive you?
Oh, Hubert Humphrey, he was just wonderful. He pumped my hand, and he was asking me about Chicago, how I like Washington, D.C., and still shaking hands. We must have shook hands for a good 3 minutes.
And what about Barry Goldwater, who was Now, Hillary Clinton was a Goldwater girl, and Ronald Reagan's mentor is Barry Goldwater. And if you think about the current philosophy, conservative philosophy, comes from Barry Goldwater. How did he treat you, the first black Secret Service?
He folded his arms, and we never shook hands. He folded his arms and somewhat turned his back. He seemed like he was somewhat irritated that the conversation he had been having with Hubert Humphrey prior to the president calling him over was more important than what that President Kennedy was talking about at the time.
Mm.
I was surprised that he didn't even give me so much as a hello or a handshake.
Wow. Okay. At this point, you got in trouble by the same guy who called you the N-word, Henderson, who was over you, because it seems like there was nothing else for you to do but respond to the president.
Yes, that's right. There was nothing that I could do. But, see, the president had a number of major issues on his hands. The Vietnam War, and there were other things that were going on in Cuba and all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And to approach the president with some type of issue that I might have had regarding racism, I thought would not be a very good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it would really show a disrespect for the chain of command,
that's
which
right.
I was bound to use. So I thought it would be best to solve that problem by going through the regular chain of command, which meant going to the chief of the Secret Service itself and explaining my objections to the actions of the agents directly to the chief of Secret Service. And through the proper channels, then it could reach the president and something could be done.
You mentioned being at one of the vacation spots and you got to meet Kennedy's young daughter, Caroline Kennedy, who spoke to you and wanted to play with your daughter, and Miss Kennedy being nice to you and speaking to you and everything. And you end up meeting Bobby Kennedy. Tell me the difference between a Bobby Kennedy meeting one person and a John F. Kennedy.
Bobby Kennedy impressed me like the enforcer. Like he was very pragmatic, without too much compassion. He seemed to me as one who could do what needed to be done regardless of the consequences of what anybody would say.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, John F. Kennedy seemed to me that his first reaction to a situation would be compromise and mercy, to try to come to some diplomatic conclusion. But if that conclusion could not be reached, then it could be turned over to a person like Bobby Kennedy, who could make that decision and carry it out regardless of what anybody else might think about it.
My goodness. Okay. At this point, you end up doing the detail for what? How many days were you on that detail?
I stayed there for 30 days, which is the normal probationary period for any agent who is trying out, you might say, for the detail.
And it seems like Bobby and John were really trying to get you, because you said you didn't want to go into the FBI because Bobby was saying, hey, why don't you go into the FBI? You said, no, I wanted to be a diplomat. They said, they began saying, hey, and you say you wanted to be a diplomat of an African country. They're saying, hey, you know, take one of those courses, learn one of those, get proficient in one of those languages. Once you finish that, we'll help you out. This is what Bobby and John were sitting there talking to you.
That's right. In Hyannisport, Massachusetts. Yes, we had that conversation on the beach in Hyannisport, Massachusetts. And President Kennedy told me to try to register in the Burlington School of Languages here in Chicago, learn one of the African languages, and then notify him, and he would see that whether or not I would be appointed as a diplomat or in the diplomatic services.
Hmm. Okay, it seems to me that under interview, you could have stayed in Washington if you wanted to, but it seems like because of the issues of racism, because they did not want, there's some of the things you couldn't do, like when you went to Florida, you said they did not want you to stay in a hotel with whites. That Kennedy did not know that, but Kennedy, you know, wanted you to be around as much as possible and afforded you every opportunity to do good. And it seemed like he was a man of his word. He wasn't just talking to him at the game of inclusion, but he was actually living it. But it seems like you said, hey, I don't want any part of this after for your exit interview.
Yes, that's right. That's right, because it was such a strain, and I kept bearing in mind that if a person tells you something like Harvey Henderson told me, that I was a nigger and it's going to always be a nigger, that to me was a very serious statement that he made, and it showed something above just a normal racist attitude. Now, we are walking around there carrying .357 Magnums on our side, and all sorts of weaponry, and accidents could happen.
Right.
And I just would rather not put myself in a situation where I am surrounded by a bunch of racist agents, and all of them are carrying guns. So
right.
I opted out not to continue my presence on the White House detail after the 30-day probationary period.
So you told the man there what happened. You end up leaving, going to Chicago, giving them an interview, and about what happened there. You end up going in there as a mountaineer, and then another person that was the actual head, they end up kind of going at each other. It seems like you were the best because you were bringing in people for counterfeiting and that whole thing. What if anybody else that caused some problems in the office there? That's trying to speed along. There were some problems that ultimately happened. What happened after you got back after that point?
Well, after I got back,
Kennedy gets killed.
Yes. Then I was very open in my criticism of the Secret Service, because during my 30-day probationary period, I had seen myself the drinking and the laxity of the agents that was occurring on the detail. And I expressed the attitude that if anything should happen in an emergency situation regarding the president, such as an assassination attempt, that the agents would not be in a condition to respond. And I hammered that home every chance that I got. When the president came here again in 1963, I hammered it home again, because when the president came here again in 1963, I saw a repeat of that same conduct. So that meant that nothing was really changing around the president of the United States. His security was not getting better, and it was remaining the same.
It seems like he was about to get assassinated in Chicago and Tampa. And you're saying before he got killed in and he had to cancel those trips there. But you said that before he went to Dallas, that the night before, the Secret Service people were drinking all night, and ultimately, at one point in time, somebody lost their security badge or something like that?
Yes, the commission book. Now, what I say is that they were had a habit of drinking and being lax around the president. Now, at the time that I made those statements, of course, they were denied.
but they were confirmed in investigations by other committees, Stokes Committee on Assassination. Those the facts and the evidence that the agents were in fact drinking on duty was confirmed by outside investigators.
Mm.
Now, the president's security detail is supposed to be a 24-hour assignment, and so that you must be ready at all times in order to carry out such an awesome responsibility of protecting the life of the president. And as I say, I complain so much about it that I think that they began to say, this guy is kind of dangerous here after the president was assassinated, so we better take means and measures to sort of quiet him down and send a message to the other agents as to what's going to happen if they should take the same route that he's taking.
Were there secret agents in there, say, of the Southern ilk that hated President Kennedy, and you thought could compromise the security as a result of them, and they hate?
Yes, very definite. And some of the conversations I had, which were also reported to my supervisor, I heard agents say that if anyone should try to assassinate the president, that they wouldn't respond. They say if shots were fired, that they would duck rather than give their life to the president, for the president, because of his racial integration policies. I actually heard agents say this, and I thought that that was a very dangerous thing to say, because it shows that the American people could not count on the Secret Service to protect the life of the president as their charter demanded that they do. Now, these other investigations, especially the one in Miami, Florida, it mirrored what actually happened in Dallas, Texas, in that these assassins were talking about killing the president with a high-powered rifle.
Mm.
When the president was to come to Chicago in November of 1963, we also got a call. It was an anonymous call that the president would be assassinated with a high-powered rifle at Jackson Street and Congress Expressway here in Chicago. So, and that visit to Chicago was canceled by the president.
Wow. Okay. Now, after this point, there's also I read in the book that there was a shot that was heard, and one of the young Secret Service people that was running to cover the president ultimately was told not to cover the president during the time he was in Dallas being shot at, which ultimately ended his life.
Yes, that's right. That's true, and that also has been verified by other commission investigators. And I knew that from what had been said at record meetings and informal discussions about the assassination of the president. That one agent, and I have his name, but Random House decided not to put his name in the book. He went to leave the running board, and he was called back to the follow-up call for some unknown reason, and he was very dejected about that. And the commission book incident came because that after that the shots were fired that mortally wounded the president, one of the officers who was on the presidential detail ran behind the picket fence. And he was shown some Secret Service identification by a man who was standing behind the picket fence and who identified himself as a Secret Service agent and had all the credentials to prove that he was a Secret Service agent.
But you believe that he was not a Secret Service agent?
No, I don't think he was a Secret Service agent. No, I think that he had access to the identification by some means and methods that... I'm really not positive, but there were some allegations that the drinking that the agents were doing the night before may have been contributory to the loss of some identification of some kind. And as a result of that, the Secret Service identification was changed. They changed all of the Secret Service identification books in about January of 1965.
This is Oldfield. I'm speaking to Mr. Abraham Bogdan. He is the author of the Echo Fenton Daily Calendar. He's the first African-American Secret Service on on the detail of a John F. Kennedy. Okay, you go to Washington, D.C., for a training after all of this has happened. And at this point, you try to get in contact with the Warren Commission to kind of give your side of the story, but of course, some secret agents don't want you to do this. So, as quick as you can, tell me what happened from then all the way up until you going to jail.
Well, I was in Washington, D.C. to go to attend a Secret Service school, but I had also confided to few other agents here in Chicago, just in case anything should happen to me, my intentions to petition J. Lee Rankin, who was one of the counsels for the Warren Commission, to let me appear before that commission, because it was my feeling that there was an orchestrated effort being undertaken by the Secret Service to conceal facts that were very important for the Warren Commission to come to a decision. And as a result of that, on May 18th, when I was in Washington, D.C., I was brought out of Washington, D.C. on a pretext. They told me that I was being brought to Chicago for an investigation going on here in Chicago in Villa Park. And I knew right away that there was something phony about that. So as a result, they brought me back here, and I found out that they were actually placing me under arrest. They held me incognito for about 24 hours after I came here. I couldn't call my wife. I couldn't call anybody, an attorney. They didn't let me eat or anything. And finally, the inspector who accompanied me here to Chicago blurted out during a stage of my investigation here. He blurted out, he says, look, Bolin, he says, Kennedy is dead. We did our best. And we're not going to stand by and watch you destroy the Secret Service. And that let me know basically what this whole thing was about. So I went through two trials here in Chicago on trumped up charges of soliciting a bribe and conspiracy, which was hatched by two counterfeiters here in the Chicago area, both of whom I had a part in their arrest. And I was taken to trial and found guilty by an all-white jury in a second trial. And
the first trial, there was a black woman that made sure you did not go to jail because she held that because she did not believe everything.
Yes, that was Miss Anna B. Hightower. I never will forget her, and may God bless her wherever that she is.
And Judge Cohen said to the jury that he believed that you were guilty.
Yes, which is unheard of.
Right.
The jury was deliberating, and the judge expressed his own opinion. He says that, in my opinion, the evidence shows that the defendant is guilty of counts 1, 2, and 3 in the indictment. And not only did he do that, he let the jury go back in. He says, now with these new instructions that I've given you, go back in and deliberate. And I was just flabbergasted. I couldn't believe that that my ears, had heard right. And so as a result of that jury was hung because Anna B. Hightower could see through the facade of these two false trials that I was enduring.
So at this point, you had the prosecutor, they found out that the prosecutor actually suborned perjury, that he helped one of the victims lie in your case. They found that out in another case. On appeal, that was found out, or you guys had actually exculpatory evidence that would clear you, but it seems like the judge, because he had already made his decision, he did not want to go back on that. And in appeals courts, people understand that they don't really look at the facts of the case, they look at the legal premises of the case. And it seems like your lawyer, Smith, not Harris, but Smith, did you a disservice, because when he was asked by the appeals court, what did he want to have done? I just took a test this past weekend that says that it's called the MPR, the Multi-State Professional Responsibilities Test. It's normally you see a lawyer do something that's dishonest. If your client does not protest it, you must report that lawyer to a tribunal. He was there being asked if the lawyer for his lying and suborning perjury that ultimately harmed you in your case, what should he do? And he basically said nothing.
Yes, that's right.
And that's why I believe that judge came up to him and blessed him out. And that's why I believe that they did not overturn the facts of your case, because it had the legal issue in your case, because the attorney there did not do what he was supposed to do, his due diligence, and noted that the issue was important as it needed to be in order to overturn and send it back to the lower court.
That's right. And he did not make the fact that the Assistant United States Attorney took the Fifth Amendment. He did not make that a point of appeal to the United States Supreme Court either, which I thought that that would have been our best appeal petition for certiorari.
Right. Let me pause here for a brief spatial identification. I'm going to have him on, you on, Mr. Baldwin, just for a couple more minutes, although I'm past my show, because I really wanted to get to some of the ending points.
1480
PM,
Vancouver, Portland.
Why do you believe, because I read in this number, Robert Kennedy knew about your case, but he did not help. Why do you believe he did not help?
Well, Robert Kennedy himself, as you know, after his brother was assassinated, Katzenbach took over. And I think that Robert Kennedy was in such grief himself, and that he was so puzzled himself that he had really turned over the authority of the office to his Deputy Attorney General Katzenbach. And so I think that's the main reason that he didn't come forth and say anything. Plus, there was a lot of speculation going on as to what was the truth of his brother's death, and I think that he just wanted to stay clear of it. Bobby Kennedy just wanted to stay clear of it until, you might say, that the dust settled and he could really find out what happened.
And he believed that there was a more than just a Harvey Lee Oswald situation, that there was a conspiracy in the killing of his brother.
I think that was the attitude amongst most of the agents. I know it was the attitude amongst the Secret Service agents at the office in Chicago here. Now, when the chief government witness, Spagnoli, when he admitted that he and this guy, Frank Jones, set up this thing, he admitted that to my attorney. He called one of my attorneys and said, we set this whole thing up with the help of the Secret Service.
Did your attorney Howard ever produce that affidavit about
the phone call? Oh, yes. We found affidavit before the Court of Appeals. Yes, we did. And it was also introduced in our brief before the Court of Appeals.
But this shows what happens in so many cases that nobody believes that black person that goes to jail, how the prosecutor never want to go back on their word, then have evidence if the judge is against you. And that happened a lot during that time. And because, you know, it's interesting how you say that you have in your mind, actually, you want to kill this judge as a result of that. There are some people during that time that felt that was the best way for justice. And you decided, no, you're going to go ahead and move through with the system. And have some faith in the system, although ultimately the system did not work in your favor.
No, it did not. I was sent away into the penitentiary, and I had endured some very harsh confinement in the penitentiary. As a matter of fact, at one point, I think that they had some ideas of trying to declare me insane.
Yes.
And the advantage of doing that would have been that as a federal prisoner, you cannot spend time as a federal prisoner if you're not in your right frame of mind.
Right.
So that if you're declared insane, I could be there now, still serving a 6-year sentence.
Right. Right.
And they, until I'm declared sane again, then my time, my sentence starts again, and then I would be completing my sentence about right now.
You know,
so that was their advantage of trying to do that. Of course, you know in the book that that didn't work out.
Right. You had these visions when you were very young. You had a vision that you want to be in this box, and this woman and these three children that turned out later on in life to be your wife and children. You saw when you went to Washington D.C. this cloud over the president's office, and a seat right after that he ended up dying. Did you ever think while you were in jail, and they put you in this mental area, that maybe I'm in heaven?
Yes, that crossed my mind. As I was discussing with my son and a group of people last night, sure it did. I wondered, you know, am I snapping or just what's going on here? And especially those visions that I had while I was incarcerated, which I describe in the book. And but the thing that lets me know that it wasn't a case of mental stress or anything like that is that each of these came true. I mean, as you read the book, you know that each of these experiences are indicated and they were verified, and something good came out of them.
Get this book. The book is The Echo from Billy Plaza, the true story of the first African-American on the White House Secret Service detail and his quest for justice after the assassination of JFK, Mr. Abraham Bowman. I tell you, better than the movie JFK. And if somebody, and we talked and you said that somebody will be doing a screenplay and looking at a movie on this, make sure the screenplay writer is a bad person, because you deal with race in here in a way that I think is so important. And if you get a white writer, they're going to want to dismiss it or they're going to want to make it weak. But I think it has to be strong the way you lay it out, because that's what kept me in the book, the understanding both times.
Yes.
Mr. Abraham Bowman, thank you. And how can people get this book?
Well, they can get that book from any of the Borders or Barnes & Noble bookstores. And if they want to contact me, I have a website here. It's www.echofromdealeyplaza.net. They can write me at Abraham Bowman Sr., P.O. Box 20416, Chicago, Illinois 60620.
And to your wife, Barbara, who stuck with you, all the love and respect to that woman in the world.
Yeah. See, I knew her. We grew up together. We married and raised three wonderful children together, and I miss her dearly. I really do. She was the resource behind all of the good that I did on this earth during those 49 years where we were married together.
And when did she die?
She died on December 27, 2005.
And
we went out 2 weeks before that and celebrated the completion of the book together.
Mm.
And she died a couple of weeks later.
Wow. All right, Mr. Abraham Bowman, thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. That is why our press was protected by the Supreme Court, the only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution, not primarily to amuse and entertain, not to emphasize the trivial and the sentimental, not to simply give the public what it wants, but to inform, to arouse, to reflect, to state our dangers and our opportunities, to indicate our crises and our choices, to lead, mold, educate, and sometimes limit anger, public opinion. This means greater coverage and analysis of international news, for it is no longer far away and far, but close at hand and local.
In the 1700s, slaves rebelled in Santo Domingo and slaughtered 60,000 people. In 1831, on July 4th, America, my country, Susan B., was first found in Boston. At the end of the song, sing, let freedom ring.
John, saluting. Thank you.